Ciao. Ms. LeBron Dykeman.
May it please the court. The district court, the district court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of R.J. Bertel on appellant's breach of contract claims after improperly resolving
Counsel,
questions.
Before you get into the merits, I'm worried about subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay.
Hicklin Engineering is not a corporation.
Correct.
So we need to know the citizenship of all of its members and the citizenship of all of their members. I look for those details in your jurisdictional statement, and they're not there.
Your Honor, we did supply in the jurisdictional statement that the members of Hicklin include Hicklin, which is an Iowa corporation, Hicklin Inc., as well as Hicklin Engineering, are both located and residing in Iowa. Another entity is NDSDIC LP, which is a North Dakota limited partnership. That partnership is made up of individuals who are residents of Iowa.
Well, we actually attempted to check that. It's not true. There's no such entity in North Dakota. There are some similarly named entities in North Dakota, but we couldn't find what their citizenship was. There is, for example, an NDSBIC LP in North Dakota, but with all those letters, one can't figure out what's what. But I can assure you there's no such entity as the one your disclosure statement says is a member.
Your Honor, I'll have to confirm if that is typographical.
And moreover, as I say, the problem is that your jurisdictional statement does not comply with the court's rules. It just says in the end, well, there are people from states X, Y, and Z, and none from the same state as the defendant. Our rule requires you to identify who they are, precisely so we can do this checking. So what it may be that we have jurisdiction, it may be that we don't have jurisdiction, but I would like to know the details, including a correct identification of all of the members of Hicklin.
I understand that,
and
Your Honor.
A correct identification of all of the members of the members, if the members are themselves unincorporated associations.
Your Honor, we did try to provide that, and that we did supplement on jurisdictional statements as after the court notified us that there was a problem with that, and we did attempt to locate that information from our client. And I can't tell you if this is and I apologize, I can't tell you if the NDSDIC is a typographical error and should be SBIC, but we did
and
make...
Its filing, by the way, with the state is inactive, so it may be that NDSBIC doesn't exist either.
Your Honor, I can't answer with respect to that today. We certainly attempted to make those verifications prior to filing the appeal here, and I certainly can go back and confirm with respect to that. But we did attempt to make sure that there was subject matter jurisdiction.
Ms. LeBron, you may have 10 days to supplement your jurisdictional statement.
Your Honor, we will take care of that. Thank you.
And remember, all of the members and all of the members' members.
Correct.
Down till we get to natural people or corporations.
Your Honors, the fighting issue on summary judgment was whether an implied agreement of confidentiality existed between appellant and Bartel, who worked for appellant for nearly 7 years drafting computer-aided design, or CAD, drawings of Acceline's proprietary transmission testing equipment. During that time, Bartel had access to all of the trade secret information of appellant. And in spite of a vast amount of evidence offered by appellant at the district court level on summary judgment respecting the question of whether or not there was a implied agreement of confidentiality, the district court granted Bartel's motion, finding there was no implied agreement. She based this finding on, after weighing the evidence, which is an error at the summary judgment stage. Most notably, she looked at competing affidavits of the parties. Appellant provided the affidavit of its president, Scott Giles, and and R.J. Bartel offered an affidavit of Bartel. In Scott Giles' affidavit, he testified that during one of the last conversations he had with Bartel, Bartel both acknowledged that he understood the confidential nature of appellant's trade secret information respecting its transmissions.
I have one other procedural question for you when we talk about the confidential nature. The magistrate judge said that her opinions were sealed, and I don't understand that at all. I've read them, and I don't see any confidential information in them. And moreover, I don't see any motion from either party allowing them to remain sealed in this court. So on what basis are these opinions sealed?
I believe that they're sealed, Your Honor, with respect...
We have said, I think, in the clearest possible terms that judges cannot keep their opinions secret.
Your Honor, I can't speak to why the judge kept her opinion secret or put it under seal.
Is there any basis, in your view, for doing so? Is there any trade secret information in the opinion?
I'd have to go back and look at the details. My recollection is that she does not include information that the parties included, such as the drawings.
It certainly didn't look like it to me. And in any event, I can't imagine why it wouldn't be the judge's duty to produce both open and redacted versions, as indeed you have done with your opening brief.
Your Honor, I can't answer that.
I mean, the country wouldn't have been very happy if the Supreme Court issued a sealed opinion in the Pentagon Papers case.
I agree
with
you.
Nobody can read it.
I'm not sure there is. The parties did submit their briefs.
So far as I know, there is no legal authority whatsoever for this step. And I'm just surprised that neither side has paid any attention to it, and our clerk's office appears to have acted in error in allowing them to remain secret. But since you say there is nothing, there's no trade secret information in them, we'll just drop them in the public record.
Your Honor, I believe that her actual opinion does not include any of the trade secrets
okay.
of appellant. Scott Giles testified that both that Mr. Bartel expressed his understanding of the confidential nature of the trade secret information, and he expressed his understanding of his obligation to maintain that information secret. Mr. Bartel's declaration in support of his position does not dispute those facts. What it states is that he was asked to sign a written confidentiality agreement and refused to do so. The court reviewed those declarations and made a factual determination. She ignored the information that was in Scott Giles' declaration and looked solely to the information that was in R.J. Bartel's declaration, indicating that he refused to sign that. The problem with this is that she's stepped outside of her bounds on summary judgment. Factual credibility determinations are generally made by the trier of fact. If a court believes that there is absolutely no credibility to a declaration, she may certainly disregard it. But the judge here made no finding with respect to that. Instead, she just weighed the declarations together and made her own determinations. For that reason alone, we believe that the court's decision should be overturned. Moreover, regarding this same claim, the breach of contract claim, the court also erred in judging other facts, in weighing out those facts and determining the ultimate question of law, whether there was a meeting of the minds between the parties with respect to this confidentiality clause of the implied agreement. She ignored, for example, facts that relate to the fact that this man worked for appellant and no other person in this transmission testing equipment for over 7 years. During the entire tenure, he acted consistent with an understanding that there was a confidentiality obligation. He never disclosed any information to competitors. He didn't disclose them to third parties. And even when dealing with customers, he spoke with people at Hickline or Axeline to ask them if it was okay to go ahead and show pictures to the customers. He also, at his own suggestion, put on information indicating that these documents, these drawings, were property, and the information contained therein were property of appellant, recognizing that the ownership belonged with appellant. Duane Schultz, who was also who both hired Mr. Bartel and supervised him, also testified that there was no need for a written agreement because the confidentiality was just understood. Moreover, it was the common practice in the industry, testified by Mr. Bartel as well as other individuals, including individuals he worked with subsequent to when he stopped working for appellant, that if you had information that was confidential, you maintained that information confidential. Even after Mr. Bartel was no longer working for appellant, he was asked on at least one occasion to provide information that was confidential to appellant, and he refused to do so. It's only in his belated attempts to avoid this obligation that he testifies that the only reason he had no obligation is because that obligation was not expressed in writing. He testified to that on deposition. That's also included in his summary judgment papers at the district court, that he had no obligation, quote, in writing. This isn't a breach of written contract case or an express contract. This is a breach of an implied contract. All of these facts taken together and viewed in the light most favorable to the appellant, Hicklin Axeline, as they must be at the summary judgment stage, mandated a denial of Bartel's motion for summary judgment, because at a minimum they created a genuine issue of material fact respecting the clause of confidentiality in the implied contract.
Was there a change in attitude or in relationship when Hicklin took over?
There was a change in the sense that Mr. Bartel did not get along with the owners of Hicklin, whereas he was much more friendly with the people running the Axeline company. But there was no change in position of with respect to whether things were perceived to be confidential or not. The information was confidential all along. Mr. Bartel offers other reasons if the court were to reverse the decision with respect to the judgment with respect to this issue. He offers other reasons as to why he believes the decision should be upheld. Those arguments as well fail. First of all, he argues that the agreement is unenforceable because it has no temporal or geographic limitations. As the court found, however, there's no Wisconsin decision that requires temporal or geographic limitations when you're dealing with matters of intellectual property such as trade secrets. He also argues that the agreement is unenforceable under the statute of frauds. Statute of frauds, however, is an affirmative defense which must be pled in an answer. Mr. Bartel did not plead in his answer, and moreover, he did not raise it until the summary judgment stage, long after the case had been pending. As the court found, that could not, even if it were a viable defense in another situation, in this situation, that would not apply. With respect to the issue of the trade secret misappropriation, the court based her holding with respect to that solely on the basis of her finding with respect to the breach of contract case. She determined there was no breach of contract, there was no duty of confidentiality, therefore there could be no trade secret misappropriation. If the court reverses on the breach of confidentiality, the breach of the confidentiality agreement, it likewise should reverse with respect to the trade secret case as well. Again, Bartel offers arguments as to why, even if the court were to find that the court should uphold the judgment, and these as well should be rejected. First, he claims that the appellant's trade secrets were not properly or sufficiently defined. Appellant provided information both in its interrogatories and more specifically in its expert report, which specified over 100 examples of situations where Mr. Bartel copied dimension for dimension, tolerance for tolerance, part shape for part shape, hole pattern for hole pattern of all of the drawings that he used when he was with, or that he created for appellant when he was there. There's nothing further that that appellant could have done to define those trade secrets. Moreover, these are the same types of things that Mr. Bartel claims to be trade secret in his own competing business. And additionally, there are information that have been, these types of information, particularly tolerances and dimensions, are types of information that have been found to be trade secrets in the past in other cases. Bartel also claims that he tries to create this as a copyright case, and it is not a copyright case. It is a breach of contract and a trade secret misappropriation case. What's at issue in this case is the information contained within the CAD drawings or CAD drawings that Mr. Bartel created for appellant and on behalf of appellant. Things that are subject to copyright can also be subject to trade secret protection, and here they were subject to trade secret protection.
Is there any claim that information in these drawings was information that Hicklin, well, actually its predecessor, gave to Bartel rather than information that Bartel created?
Much of this information, it was all information that he got from the folks at Axeline. He worked with them. He worked with their engineers. Many of the drawings...
It wasn't all information he got from them. He was being hired as an engineer and not just as a technical draftsman.
He was a draftsman. He was taking the... Many of the drawings that he created were...
Was there any effort in the district court to separate the information that Hicklin provided from the information that Bartel created?
No, Your Honor. The reason being is that that information that he, any information that he did on the drawings, which were not things that he took from paper drawings and made into CAD drawings, was information that he created while working with integrally related to those folks at Axeline, the engineers that were there. It was their knowledge that he was just putting onto paper. So it was not something he brought in from outside. Instead, it was something that he was taking from the knowledge of the Hicklin-Axeline engineers and using. Your Honors, I think I will reserve the rest of my time, if I may, for rebuttal.
Surely. Thank you. Mr. Boyle?
Good morning. Thank you. Jim Boyle, representing defendants. I'd just like to note Rick Bartel is here with me today, sitting in the front row. To quickly answer two issues you brought up, Judge Easterbrook, regarding the sealed decisions. I wrote to Judge Gorenson and told her that exact point, that those decisions really should not be sealed. I totally agree. There's no basis in the law. More than that, I asked her.
Did she respond to this?
It was just a letter. No response. I reflected and wondered if I should have made a motion, but, you know, how much effort do I need to take on this? So, but definitely a letter from me to her saying there's no reason to be sealing those motions. And I totally agree that what is supposedly the trade secret information is not even mentioned in her decisions, nor is that really even a basis for the why we moved for summary judgment. So no reason for those to be sealed. Regarding the issue of the separation of information that Hicklin gave to him versus he did, totally agree. There was no effort to separate that at all.
But isn't that the critical question? What's bugged me since I started thinking about this is the parallel to legal practice. Lawyers are usually operating as independent contractors for their clients. A lawyer can get information. One spectacular example is information about an impending tender offer. The lawyer is asked to draw up the necessary documents. Now, which of this information is the lawyer obliged to keep confidential? The lawyer will not negotiate a separate confidentiality agreement. You know, I've always thought the lawyer was obliged to keep confidential the information that came from the client about the secret aspects of the business, the impending tender offer or something else, but that the lawyer's own work product, what the lawyer added was his own, so that if the lawyer drafts an interesting document, he could reuse it for some other client without facing suit from the first client saying, you drafted this form of Regulation 14D filing while you were working for us, so you can't use it for any other client.
I totally...
So that would be the critical question. Which of this information was Hicklin's information, and which of this information was Bartel's? But nobody seems to have paid any attention to this distinction.
I totally agree, and unlike the lawyer situation in which we are obligated by rule to maintain information confidential, there is no rule or contract here, so once the information is released from Hicklin to an outsider, that ceases to be confidential, at least with respect to Rick. I was going to use an analogy. This brief, same example. You have one, Rick's got one, but this one right here in my hands, this one's mine. And I'm going to keep it. I'm going to take it back. Maybe it's good, maybe it's not, but I can use it later.
Yeah, well, tender offers you might think of from another perspective. One of the very first inside trading tender offer prosecutions arose out of the behavior of a financial printer. The financial printer had not technically agreed by contract to keep the information secret. But there were steps taken, like the use of code words and the standard ethics of the profession, to keep it secret. And when Vincent Chiarella broke the code and traded, he was criminally prosecuted. And nobody, so far as I know, nobody even thought to defend the Chiarella case by saying, but they didn't force me personally to sign a particular contract. They were having a fight about where the information came from and what the normal way in which that was handled was. And that I would have supposed would be the fight here. Whose information was it? Was it what Hicklin brought to the table or what Bartel brought to the table? Since there was no contract, each owned what he brought to the table. But Bartel, having worked with Hicklin, didn't get a right to appropriate what Hicklin brought to the table.
He certainly has a right to keep his own work product.
Yeah, but that's exactly the question. What was his own work product? Nobody seems to have paid any attention to this.
Right, and that's the issue is whether they gave him something, some old drawings, that's going back to 93. No one really cares. But when he's got on his machine drawings, that's what they want taken from him, his drawings. And they're on his machine. They're CAD drawings on his machine for only one reason, because he put them there. He created them.
Well, you say that he had certain proprietary interests in his own stuff, right?
Totally.
Yeah. Well, if Hicklin had, I don't know how he'd get a hold of it, but if it decided they no longer, whatever their disagreement was, weren't getting along, could it take whatever all his stuff was wholesale, give it to somebody else, and continue producing these machines?
Yes. He was hired to give them drawings.
Bartel would have no recourse then.
We wouldn't take any. It would be
done with the
understanding. You're doing drawings and you're giving it to your client, done with the understanding, total understanding, that the client is, of course, going to build equipment, might move those manufacturing facilities to Iowa or wherever, might sell the whole business to somebody else. Sure. Hicklin could take those drawings. Sure, there'd be, I guess, an implied license, so to speak. But nothing to prevent him or preclude him from using his own work product.
Well, so you say, although that very question went to the Supreme Court in Community for Creative Nonviolence against Reed, a case that the parties have not devoted very much attention to.
He asked four simple questions in this case. Rick, were you ever actually employed by Hicklin? No. Rick, did you ever have a written agreement with Hicklin? Any contract at all? No. Did anybody ever actually talk to you about it? No. Well, not until the last day. I said no. Well, who actually drew these drawings? Well, I did. That's it. It's done. On what basis do you file a claim that he's misappropriating something?
Well, I guess in Wisconsin law, an implied agreement of confidentiality, which, of course, is what's before us. That's the question. Is there something beyond a written contract that preserves this right?
And we've gone through a laundry list of evidence here that supposedly raised some question. Number one, Dwayne Schultz, the general manager, the principal contact Rick had with Axeline, he understood something.
Let me put it this way. One of these drawings appears in the sealed version of Hicklin's brief. and it was put there by Hicklin's law firm. Do you think that law firm now owns that drawing and can sell it to the highest bidder because it's in a brief?
Well, that's a kind of, I don't know that they ever had possession.
The answer is surely no, right? Even though they are independent contractors, they never worked as Hicklin's employees.
But they didn't create the drawing.
Exactly. Well, but that comes back to my question.
These two drawings right here.
Did the information...
These are both Rick Bartels.
Look, did the information... Was the information created by Bartel as an engineer telling Hicklin what tolerances to use... Or did Hicklin tell Bartel what tolerances to use, and Bartel then put it in the drawing? Right? That tells us who the owner of the information was.
The vast majority of it...
I'm now tired of saying neither side seems to have pinned this down or made very much turn on this.
Well, you're right. And from my perspective, I wasn't going to go pin it down because that's one of the great failings of their case. That was one of my grounds for moving for summary judgment. They never said it. And one of the great injustices are here. That's not quite the right word, but they filed, if you read their complaint, they filed a complaint on the grounds that the complaint says I misappropriated some product idea called a torque converter dynamometer. I defy you to look at anywhere in the record to see what such a thing is. Defy you to find any document as to what such a thing is. To our knowledge, no product has ever existed. They instead, halfway through the case, say, no, he misappropriated this huge laundry list of general things, specifications and dimensions and financial information. It's in their interrogatory answer. They never specified, and that was one of my grounds for moving for summary judgment, is that they never specified it. That's their I'm not going to go through that effort.
They never specified what, Mr. Boyle? Who created those things?
They never specified what specifically the secrets supposedly are, and then never got into the issue of who developed the drawings, whose information got it. Because you're right, for his work product, how does that become theirs? It doesn't. There's also, they talk about various grounds for confidentiality. You know, any obligation ends the day he stops working there. It's a simple contract at will. We're looking for just two things here, Your Honors. Affirm the judgment and end this case. All Rick Bartel has ever wanted is to wash his hands and be done with these people and walk away from them. And the second thing is, he really should be made whole here. This case never should have been brought.
Thank you, Mr. Boyle. Ms. LeBron-Dyckman.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue is with respect to who created the drawings. I think Judge Easterbrook notes on that. In this situation...
No, not who created the drawings. Who created the information in the drawings?
The information contained within, and that was Hicklin. Hicklin provided the information...
Do you know that from this record? Does the record establish that unambiguously?
I believe it does, Your Honor. I believe the deposition testimony by Rick Bartel, the deposition testimony by Joanne Schultz, discusses the fact that what he was hired to do was to draw for them. And he came in and initially started with the respect of just transferring old drawings into CAD drawings and ultimately worked with them as they made changes.
Those drawings are easy enough to...
Sure.
...to work on. What about the work after the copying, that's probably an inappropriate layman's term, but after the copy, to Judge Easterbrook's critical inquiry, what's in the record to show us that what Mr. Bartel's hand applied to the paper, placed there, was idea matter that was transmitted to him?
I believe, again, it is the deposition testimony of Dwayne Schultz and Bartel himself, that what he was doing was his drawings were reflections of information provided to him by Axeline and Hicklin. That they were the engineers working within Hicklin were the ones who created the information, figured out the dimensions, figured out the information with respect to that. Mr. Bartel had no history in this at all. He had no understanding of this type of work. He had never been involved in it before. You're talking engineers who had expended extensive years, time, labor, money, working on these to develop these transmission testing equipment, this looking at every car and its transmission and how that fit in, coming up with certain hole patterns and dimensions. It is their knowledge that he was putting onto paper. He's not disputed at any point in time that what he was hired to do and what he did was make reflections of those onto CAD drawings. His only point is because he drew them, he can keep them. And that just can't be the law, that he can take that information, turn around, and become Hicklin's competitor and sell and undersell because he has not put in that same time, labor, and skill. Your Honor, I have nothing further. All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Mr. Boyle. The case is taken under advisement. The third case of the day, Margos versus